Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, Vermont Senator Peter Welch joins the show to outline his priorities in the Senate Farm Bill. Global Farmer Network founder and CEO Mary Boat also joins us to discuss how farmers around the world are responding to U.S. tariffs. But first, here are this week's headlines. As new world screwworm cases have reached double digits in the U.S., USDA announced funding for new projects to combat the pest. The Agriculture Department is putting $105 million into 40 research projects aimed at better equipping the U.S. to stop the spread of New World screwworm. The projects are being funded as part of a New World screwworm Grand Challenge. USDA wants to advance improvements in monitoring for wild flies, treating infected animals, and producing more sterile flies. Without new biofuel markets, America's biggest crop could be in trouble. A study from S&P Global Energy says corn farmers will grow 31% fewer acres by 2050 if key demand-boosting opportunities aren't seized. The report says that the world is producing more crops on less land, yet corresponding demand is weakening amid slower population growth and declining ethanol demand due to the rise of electric vehicles, more fuel-efficient cars, and changing driving patterns. With no changes, on-road ethanol demand could plummet almost 50%, to 6.6 billion gallons by mid-century. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley said that underscores the need for Congress to pass legislation to allow year-round voluntary E15 sales nationwide. The House passed the bill, which is now awaiting action in the Senate. The Senate is set to release Farm Bill text soon. Vermont Senator Peter Welch outlines what he'd like to see included.
We need relief for farmers, and we also need a sustainable farm policy. You know, the USDA put out some information I found really quite shocking. And it was a profile of every crop, like corn, soy, peanuts, sorghum, take your pick. But it showed that the cost of production per acre exceeded the revenue per acre for virtually all our farmers doing all their work. That's not sustainable. So, you know, immediately we've got to provide some relief to farmers who've lost their markets, who've been really hammered as a result of the tariffs, the higher cost of fertilizer, something is affected by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. The loss of, you know, so the higher prices and the higher prices they pay, like fertilizer prices, are way up. And So I think that whatever we do in the Farm Bill, there's an immediate problem, and that is with respect to ag, we're going to have to help our farmers. But secondly, we've got to start looking at the reality that this is not a sustainable situation. Farmers can't be spending more per acre than they're earning per acre. And I find it really the time where we've got to address some of these cost drivers that the farmers have no control over. You know, they create an immense amount of wealth. They just don't get any. And that's not right. It's not sustainable. But another part of the Farm Bill traditionally has always been the food program, the SNAP program. And there's a big battle because that is, quote, expensive. But what an individual gets is a few dollars a day. And these are very low income people, and they absolutely need that nutrition assistance. And traditionally in the Farm Bill, we've had a united front where the urban area folks really who need food stamps or focus on that, work with the ag people to make certain that we have decent programs for our farmers. So that is still a divide here that is going to be problematic, and we've got to resolve it.
Yeah. And you talked about that food and farm coalition. We saw budget reconciliation last summer. There were some shift of the SNAP program, shifting some of those costs to states. I mean, is that something that you and Democrats will still be looking to rescind some of those, that some of that cost shift here in the Farm Bill?
Well, you know, it was pretty bizarre what happened. The states that had the highest error rate got the most aid. Now, usually it provided incentive to make certain that the error rate is lower. So that is really kind of upside down. And that's an issue that has to be addressed. The second thing is nobody wants fraud in any program, whether it's a farm program that's providing direct assistance to farmers in the commodity programs, or it's in the SNAP program, the food program. But where you use the threat or the specter of fraud as a means by which you essentially make it impossible for people who are eligible for food stamps or the SNAP benefits to get access to them. That's about lowering the standards and taking away something that families really need. So that's an ongoing battle, but I think we're making some good progress on that. Because again, you know, there's people that are hungry in red states, and there's people that are hungry in blue states.
We'll be back with more newsmakers right after this.
As a cooperative, our customers are our owners. They share our profits and help guide our business. We're not just another lender. We're Farm Credit, and we're here for you.
Think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you
yes.
asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
USDA has seen large staff reductions in the past year and a half. I asked Vermont Senator Peter Welch if he's confident that USDA offices across the country are sufficiently staffed.
Well, they're not. We're way down. I mean, scores of staff positions. And what I said to Secretary Rollins is that we need those people. And the USDA has a very good reputation in Vermont. So I was praising the Department of Agriculture and the Secretary for the good service that those people have provided to Vermonters. But I know with a lot of my counterparts, their experience is the same things. You know, there were a lot of DOGE cuts. The secretary had nothing to do with that. And then there's been an inability to refill positions. So I made my point to her, and others have made it as well. And I'm getting a sense that she is taking quite seriously the necessity of staffing up to make certain that the programs that are really beneficial to our farmers are able, we can implement them.
Yeah. Are you hearing specific concerns from farmers in your state about those farmer-facing county offices?
Well, yes. I mean, the thing about the USDA is that it's local people who know the local farmers. And of course, one of the things that's being proposed at USDA is to take a lot of the local people out and put them in Kansas or put them somewhere remote from the state they serve. And that's in the name of saving money. But, you know, there are certain things where you got to be on the scene. You've got to be present in order to be effective. And I think that's definitely the case with our farm programs.
The U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement is set for a discussion later this year. Given your state's ag sector with dairy and a lot of specialty crops, like you mentioned, you know, what will you be looking for in that renewal and as those negotiations occur later this year?
Well, two things. With respect to the USMCA in Vermont and dairy, we in Vermont would like to have more access to the Canadian dairy market. So that is a specific goal that Vermont ag would have. But with respect to the USMCA, all of Vermont benefits by having that trade agreement in place. And it's not just ag, but I'm talking about manufacturing, tourism. We're much better off with a robust agreement that has served us well. So we'd like to see it renewed ASAP.
And as you wrap up here, the Food for Peace program was administratively moved from the U.S. Agency for International Development to USDA. I mean, do you have concerns about USDA's staffing levels to support and execute that effective program? I know that you asked Secretary Rollins about this last week as well.
Yeah, I do. I mean, the Food for Peace program is something that is that Americans can rightly be proud of. It is us taking advantage of the bounty of the crops and production, the magnificent work that our farmers do across the country, and where we have a food surplus, making that available to people who are starving. It's as simple as that. And it's an excellent use of soft power. There's a lot of goodwill that comes from America providing food to places where there's starvation. So the change here, I don't have a point of view whether it's better or it's worse, But I do have concerns about the implementation and whether there'll be sufficient staffing level. So time will tell, but a number of us have made our concerns very, very clear.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Honecke looks at food spending trends in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Americans are continuing to spend more on food, both at home and at restaurants. This chart shows the total amount that Americans are spending on food at home and food away from home from 1997 to 2025, adjusted for inflation. Americans spent a total of just over $2.5 trillion on food last year. $1.4 trillion was spent when Americans went out to eat or brought prepared food, which accounted for about 56% of the total. About $1.1 trillion was spent on food from grocery stores and prepared at home. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Honecke.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper from our brand new facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put four kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
For 35 years, soybean farmers have invested together to build demand for U.S. soy at home and around the world. Through the Soy Checkoff, farmers turn every dollar into stronger markets for U.S. soybeans, driving innovation and partnerships across feed, food, fuel, sustainable production, and beyond, led by farmers and built to last. U.S. Soy, 35 years of delivering value back to the farm and investing in the future of agriculture.
Welcome back. Mary Boat serves as CEO and founder of the Global Farmer Network, an organization that connects farmers in 72 countries across six continents. To begin our conversation, I asked what sentiment she's hearing from farmers around the globe after U.S. trade and tariff policies have rippled through the world during the Trump administration.
It's been very interesting to watch. The Global Farmer Network has a WhatsApp group that is private to our members. And it has been extremely active, especially this past year. Freedom Day, when the tariffs were in, there was a lot of conversation. What does this mean? What are you doing in America? How is this? You're crazy. But the conversation has settled down a little bit. But the realities of what they mean and how people are choosing to adapt or making decisions to adapt to the realities of today, and more importantly, the uncertainties of today, has been very interesting. I'll also say they're very similar. I remember when April, when those decisions were first made, the tariffs were first announced, there was a lot of interest. What are Iowa farmers thinking about? What are they doing? They're talking about some of the decisions they'd made on their farms pre-spring that were really sheltering now. We'll wait and see what it looks like in 6 months. Well, now it's 1 year and the conversation hasn't changed. I think there is still obviously the concern with the uncertainty, the flexing up and down and not really knowing and making it difficult to plan. But the interesting part in GFN is that it's global. It is, there have been some real life impacts. One of our Canadian farmers, she shared when the tariffs were first announced, they are potato producers. They sell a lot of the potatoes to McDonald's. They had loads that were ready to go on that day that it was announced. And all of a sudden, it made a $3 million loss to their farm. So in that 1 day, $3 million. So instead of sending them, they sent them to a livestock facility and they were fed instead. I have information from a Filipino farmer right in front of me today talking about how the tariffs and the price of inputs is impacting Filipino farmers, where some of them are having to decide, is it really worthwhile for me to plant my crop this year? Because I'm not going to plant and pay to lose when I know I'm going to lose. Those are the types of difficult decisions that are being made. And yet there is a need for food. There is a need for the crops that are being produced. And what are the changes that you're making? How are you adapting to those realities so that you have a market that allows you to be sustainable, not only to be able to provide, but to be able to sustain your own farming operation?
And Mary, you're a really excellent person to talk about this with your membership all over the globe. And will you tell us a little bit more about, you know, what areas of the whole world that you represent and, you know, how that sentiment has really changed?
Absolutely. So the Global Farmer Network, what it is now, was started by five Iowa farmers. And interesting enough, trade was the issue. They were reacting to the World Trade Organization battle in Seattle, the end of 1999-2000, and this thought process that trade is bad. And there was a pullback from globalization at that time. We went from five Iowa farmers to the fact that, well, this isn't Iowa specific. We're a landlocked state, very productive, but most of our customers are not just in South Dakota, Minnesota, Illinois. They're outside of the United States. And so what does this look like? And that was the whole purpose. Today, we're working in 72 countries, six continents. And the issues remain the same: access to trade, access to markets, ability to develop markets, to send things where you can grow it well, to places where they need it or desire it, is so important. But along with that is the access to technology. We started as this group called Truth About Trade and Technology, now Global Farmer Network. But the foundational pieces of access to markets, access to technology remain steadfast. And regardless of who you are talking to, it might look slightly different, but those two fundamental pillars remain, and they are global.
We'll be back with more newsmakers right after this.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper from our brand new facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put four kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
America never stops. Thanks to the financial support of Farm Credit, neither do the farmers and ranchers who call her home. Since the beginning, we've been helping rural America show the world what hard work can achieve. But the job is far from over. And as rural America grows further, we'll be there.
Welcome back. Mary Bo is founder and CEO of the Global Farmer Network. We asked her about the technology adoption trends farmers across the world are making.
Access to technology is resilience. When we talk about resilient agriculture, sustainable agriculture, access to technology, whatever that technology is, we have a very large contingent of GFN members in India. Irrigation with whatever form it looks like, so they can produce whether there's a monsoon or whether there's a drought, is changing the landscape of India. In southern South America, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, that no-till revolution, bringing stuff in, that technology and the things they continue to learn, and that changed the way they look. We're working with some farmers in Brazil and Southeast Asia, where they're looking still, along with our European friends, to have access to more gene-edited, genetically modified crops. And so the technologies are different. What they want is access to that next technology that allows them to move up, not only in their productivity, but in their profitability. If the farmer's not profitable, he is not going to be sustainable. He's not going to be resilient, and it really doesn't matter. So with every other business, it's being able to make a profit to provide for your family. And again, that looks the same across the globe. It's a fascinating piece to watch. And I think as soon as we have that understanding, the perspective that we really do want the same things, the minutia of what that might be looks different. But the access to that technology, whatever it is critical to our ability to continually not only to produce, but to preserve at the same time.
And data has been one other big issue that we see here in the U.S. But are you hearing farmers across the globe concerned about, you know, who owns and who has the right to data as well?
I'm just going to share with you a most recent It was a bit of an eye opener for me. And I think I know it was for others in the room as well. We were recently in Sao Paulo, Brazil. We brought in 20 new farmers into the Global Farmer Network. They'd gone through this strenuous process of selection and invitation. They've been doing virtual training. And we spend 1 week with them in person doing additional training, but really talking about what are the issues that are in your country. And the question about AI, data that's collected, who owns it, what's the valuation, are you comfortable with sharing it, came up. And we did just a kind of a lightning round around that table. This were, I think there were 18 people sitting at the table at that time, 17 different countries. And the youngest one was 22, oldest person at that table was 53, just to give you a sense of that. Men and women is almost equal. And about 80% of them had no problem with sharing their data. And we talked about it, so this felt like a mind shift change. We've talked so much. We've spent a lot of time, certainly in the US, about who owns it. I don't want to share it. How to, don't give away that value. And that clearly was also part of this group. I understand the value that I hold. And whether it's a monetization or whatever that looks like, getting and retaining the value of that. But what these farmers were telling us that the ability to benchmark, to see where I am in the process of other people in the same space is invaluable to me. That also has a value. And so we really felt like it was a little bit of a mind shift. It might be generational. It might be just because we've had access to so much data for so long from our machines, from our equipment. The other conversation is, how do I know which data I should be using and how do I integrate it all together so it actually helps me make the good decisions because I have so much. And so the conversation actually went further quickly from who owns it and am I willing to share to how do I broker and utilize so that I can maximize the information that's available to me. It was a fascinating discussion.
And Mary, you founded the Global Farmer Network over 25 years ago. So you've seen a lot of changes. You've built a great network of farmers all across the globe. But what are some of the biggest changes in sentiment or farmer thoughts on some of these issues that you've observed over that time and getting to know these farmers over such a long period of time?
If I was going to tell you the power, I think, of the Global Farmer Network was the ability to connect people to each other. And I think that started by these five Iowa farmers, they were visionary in their own rights. They were all connected internationally. But we do, as countries or as commodity groups, we tend to gather together to talk about our issues or to talk about the challenges. And when we go to advocate for something, we tend to go with our group. What we've seen over the years of the Global Farmer Network is the power of collaboration, looking beyond the natural boundaries of a border or a commodity or an age section or whatever, and just on a broader thing, because when you have a global perspective, the fundamentals, that trade technology that we were founded on, but when you understand that when I make this decision in the US policy, how that in fact impacts a farmer in the UK or inspires a farmer in Japan or gives somebody in India some thought to say, how can I take that information and make it work on 2 hectares? And how can I then get that to 4 hectares because my neighbor sees it as well? And so that collaboration, that knowledge transfer has been transformable. I think if we can continue to share those stories, that growth and the power of collaboration, connecting people to each other, and then telling that same story is going to, it has already had a huge influence on our world. It can do even more.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Honecke looks at SNAP participation by state in this week's Map It Out.
USDA data shows fewer people are participating in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. This map shows the percent change in SNAP program participation from February of 2025 to this February. Every state in the continental U.S. saw fewer people in the program this year compared to last year, with Arizona seeing the biggest change at nearly 50%. 23 states have more than 10% fewer people receiving SNAP benefits this year. A fight over SNAP may be unavoidable in the Senate as lawmakers prepare to roll out draft Farm Bill text. A key flashpoint is a provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that would, for the first time, require states to cover part of SNAP benefit costs based on their payment error rates. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Honecke.
For 35 years, soybean farmers have invested together to build demand for U.S. soy at home and around the world. Through the Soy Checkoff, farmers turn every dollar into stronger markets for U.S. soybeans, driving innovation and partnerships across feed, food, fuel, sustainable production, and beyond, led by farmers and built to last. U.S. Soy, 35 years of delivering value back to the farm and investing in the future of agriculture.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we were to start lambing. and I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this farm state of mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Both the House and Senate are in session next week. Plus, USDA's crop progress report will be released on Monday. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.